Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Fighter's Voice with Don McGuire, presented by Finished MMA and the United Way Merced.
Saturday, November 24th, Oscar De La Hoya's Golden Boy Promotions presents Chuck the Iceman Liddell as he returns to the cage to take on the Huntington Beach bad boy, Tito Ortiz, in their third and final chapter of their historic rivalry at the Fabulous Forum, plus a fully stacked undercard of competitive MMA talent. Don't miss this night of historic rivalry, Saturday, November 24th at the Forum. Tickets start at $30 and are available at Ticketmaster.com or by calling 800-745-3000.
Welcome to The Fighter's Voice. I'm your host, Don McGuire. Tonight we have probably, in my heart, one of the best shows that I've ever done. You look at the 15 years in journalism that I've been doing, I've always wanted this man on my show. I've never had the opportunity, as I don't ask my brothers in the industry to hook a brother up, but this time I did. I reached out to my carnal, Jacob Duran, and I asked him if we could interview the one and only Bert Watson, and lo and behold, that's who is on tonight's show. With that being said, the babysitter, they call you the babysitter of the stars. I don't know if that is a correct calculation or formulation of who you are, but welcome to the show, Bert Watson.
Well, thank you, Dom. It's my pleasure, man. You know, it's a pleasure being with you. And you know what? That's a tag that kind of came along. You know, it came along with the game. It came along with the program. And, you know, when people give you those names, it's like anything, any type of little, it's an endearment to me, you know. It's a testament to having worked with the fighters and, you know, in some instances, in some cases, what I mean and just how things went along. So, no, I don't mind that moniker at all, baby.
You know, it's funny that you say that, and I like that because James Lights Out Tony nicknamed me Dandy Don. And everybody gave me crap for it, but you know, that's James Tony, man. I'm gonna accept that with pride. You know,
wow. And you know, I've actually worked with him. He's a pretty good friend of mine.
Yeah, Lights you know, out. I love his cigars and cognac. I tell you,
well, you know, a tremendous man. I go back a little further than that. Because at the time I went back with him, if I saw him with a cigar and too much cognac, I probably would have said something or stepped to him, you know. Because at the time I was with him, he was boxing and he was, you know, had to be in shape and stay in shape. So that was probably one of those things that they probably did in private.
Yes, sir. You know, I kind of want to take you back to the early days. What was life like for a young Bert Watson, a young man growing up in what I call the good old days? You know, as I'm 53 years old myself, what was it like for you as a young man growing up and learning intent and learning value about life?
Well, you know, it was, I came up at a time when the world was different, the world was at a crossroads. You know, I was born in the South, and my family moved to Philadelphia in 1951 or 52. You know, some of these guys, their parents were probably born back in that time. But my parents moved to Philadelphia, and that's, you know, I grew up in Philadelphia. Went to elementary school, junior high school, and high school in Philadelphia. And you know what? I came along at a time, you know, when I got out of high school and went to college, after college, you know, I went in the Marine Corps. You know, I did 3 years in the Marine Corps during the Vietnam era. I came up at a time when sports was just beginning to reach its peak. When we had Smoking Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali and George Foreman and, you know, and Larry Holmes and those guys And you had Jimmy Connors and Billie Jean King and tennis, you know, and at the time when, you know, Dr. J in basketball, Wilt Chamberlain, you know, I came up at a time or when sports started becoming an American pastime, because it was something that brought everybody together. Everybody appreciated it. Everybody enjoyed it. And everybody really came together with rooting on for their teams and certain individuals. And, you know, that was history has a way of making you a part of it without you asking for it. And that was a part of history. That was a part of history that now we look back on and we see the evolution of it. But that was history, man, and that was a great time. And that was a time I enjoyed, because I enjoyed sports and enjoyed the people that carry the mantle. Didn't know that I was going to eventually get involved and become a part of sports or sports history, but I enjoyed every bit of it, man. And, you know, we were in a different time, in a different world, and, you know, things were different. The thought processes were a little different. You know, the things that you valued or you respected was a little different. I'm old school. I'm a real OG, real OG. So, you know, there are things that we did then that were pretty natural. You know, we just did instinctively, and it was an exciting time, man.
Yeah, you know, see, that's one thing. It's crazy because you probably don't remember the couple times that I have actually met you in life. I got my start 23 years ago in boxing.
Okay.
And, you know, I do a weekly talk show on the Legends. Actually, I usually do it tonight, but getting the opportunity to interview you, I put that to the side. Usually tonight is my Legends in boxing.
Well, I greatly appreciate that, boss man.
Oh, I think it's the other way around, sir. But, you know, I look back at the words that you emulated, and it's so profound, because this sport, you truly have to love it. You truly have to live it, eat it, breathe it. It's not something that will make you rich in pocket. It'll make you rich in heart, but it won't make you rich in pocket. But the family that is created from the aspect of the sport is tremendous. Now, you went on to, like we talked about earlier, to become the baby, you know, they call you the babysitter of the stars. I, you know, and you like that moniker, so I'm not going to take it away. I have a different moniker.
Joe Rogan gave me that name, incidentally.
Yeah, Joe's agree. You know, that's one thing you can help me clear up, because people think that Joe Rogan isn't a beast that he is. They don't really understand that when jiu-jitsu and certain aspects of mixed martial arts were just fundamentally taking off here, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, that Joe Rogan was a major part of that. And, you know, people don't want to give him the credit that he deserves, you know, as a fighter in this sport.
Well,
now,
you know,
in your experiences with Joe Rogan, would you say that he's just as much a warrior as some of the fighters today?
Well, you know, people probably don't give him what just dues you think he should get, because a lot of people really don't know. I don't know what degrees or what belts that Joe Rogan holds, but if you listen, really, really listen to his commentaries and how he builds up technically a guy's move and how he gets up to a certain position, and when he's on the ground in a certain position or he's in a certain mount, what he's going to do or what he should do to either get out or reverse that particular move. If you listen to his commentary, you can see how intelligent he is in terms of what he knows. And without even thinking, if you really listen, the commentaries that he gives says he has to either sit down and repeatedly, he's probably the biggest MMA geek in the world, or he really knows what he's talking about. And he really knows what he's talking about, because he is a pretty much a little beast.
Yeah, he truly is. You know, Bert, I kind of want to take you back just a little bit, if you don't mind. I'm 53, you know, and you say you're a true OG, so I think you'll understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
True adversity in life is what defines us, and certain people and aspects truly give us the intent that we need to move forward. When you look back over the shoulder of Bert Watson in life, who would you say would be the defining character in the creation of Bert Watson?
My mother, without a doubt. You know, my mom first, and then my family. I learned from my mom that there's no such thing as no. There's no such thing as I can't. What do you mean I can't? You know, just repeating what I heard from her all the time. You know, there was no such thing as you couldn't do something, or you didn't want to do something, or no, I'm not going to do something. You know, with those things and those values that were instilled, you know, as I grew up, and how to take a penny and turn it into a dollar, and how to appreciate things that you had, you know, appreciate them as opposed to abusing them. You know, those things that I learned from my mom were instilled and ingrained and were core value things that I took with me all through life, you know, and it gave me a profound sense of respect for everything and anything. Respect for people, respect for the system, respect for men, respect for women, respect for children. It gave me that. And then as I went on and went to college and then went into the Marine Corps really reinforced that. Because, I mean, it was, hell, today I still crease my jeans. I think I'm the only person in the world that puts a pair of jeans on the ironing board and puts a crease in them. You know, I got that from my mom and then the Marine Corps. So it reinforced and instilled those things, and it gave me a sense of organizational skills, a sense of things having to have to be in place, a sense of things only get direction if it's given direction, and then you got to keep those directions. You know, that's what I learned as I, you know, grew up as a child from my mom. And then, as I said, reinforced by the Marine Corps, and that's when and where that whole organizational, creative, structural thing stuff came in my head, and it just stayed in there. And as I went along and started working, you know, I got out of the Marine Corps, and I actually started my very first job. I was in the fashion industry. I worked in New York for a company called Burlington Industries, Kloppman Mills, which made fabrics to manufacturers of men's suits. Later went on to work for Levi Strauss, which made denim, or made jeans, but I sold them the denim and got hired by them. But I started in the fashion industry and eventually ended up, you know, meeting Joe Frazier one day, and one thing led to another, and Joe and I kept in touch and stayed friends. And you know, one year to another, the next thing I know, I'm in Philadelphia, Joe Frazier's business manager. And at that point, without any experience of how to manage a person, just the fact that Joe himself was a pure person. You know, Joe himself was a person from Beaufort, South Carolina, who was taught at an early age a sense of respect and how to appreciate things that you had or you didn't have, or that you had the possibility of getting, and how to get those things, you know. And he believed in people, and he believed in giving people a chance. You know, he was probably one of the few high profile world famous athletes I know that had no problem going into the hood, into a neighborhood bar, and sitting down and having a drink and having the people sit down and look and do three double takes because they couldn't believe he was sitting in there.
Right.
That's the person that he was, and that's the person that gave me a job. So he put both feet to the fire, you know. He put both of my feet to the fire. And with that being said, and me having to have to perform at that level, you know, he said, listen, man, he said, you're a man that went to college, you were in the Marine Corps, you got a family. If you don't know how to do this, you got a real problem. You know what? That kind of took me through a whole nother level, whole nother direction. Because at that point, all I did was perform. So initially, my job for him was creating situations for him to make a living off of his name once he retired or whenever he did retire or decided to. Well, that wasn't a very hard job to do, was to sell Joe Frazier's name, you know, at that time. And I'm talking about, you know, early 80s or so. That was not a real hard job to do. But the organization of it, the organizational structure of it, you know, I took over at the gym. You know, he had a limousine service. He was promoting fights. He had quite a few things going on in out of that gym and out of Smoking Joe Frazier, Inc., that, you know, I had to put in line and put an organizational structure to it. So I was I had my feet put to the fire at a very high level and couldn't look back.
No, I mean, you know, and the way you talk about it, it just, it kind of took me, I hope you don't mind, it took me a step back, you know, in my relationship with Muhammad Ali. You know, he's another individual in the boxing and the sweet science world that truly emulated greatness. And, I mean, you just couldn't help.
If you know I worked with Joe Frazier, you know I had some kind of connection, and as a matter of fact, a very personal connection with Muhammad Ali that developed over the years. In 1989, and I told you I was an OG, now I'm dating myself, we did a video project called Champions Forever. And that was a video project with Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali, George Foreman, Ken Norton, and Larry Holmes. That was the fight that those guys had with each other over the decades or two. And, you know, we did that video and did a video tour, you know, all over the world. And when the video came out on HBO, Reggie Jackson was the narrator for the video. So I traveled with those guys about three years promoting that video and promoting those guys. And I got to know them, and I got to really work with them, you know, and become closer, not only because I was with Joe, but I became closer with those guys. Ironically, I became close enough to Muhammad and the rest of them that I think in 2000 and maybe 5 or 6, someone introduced me to Muhammad Ali's daughter, Layla Ali, and she was just beginning to started her boxing career, and I was the guy they hired to coordinate and organize that, which I did. The irony is that I did that, and in 2008, I was also the coordinator for the fight between Layla Ali and Jackie Frazier. So here it was 20-whatever years later, I did the fight between the two daughters up at the Turning Stone Casino in Oneida, New York, you know, and I became very close. I got to know Joe's daughter, her husband. I got very close. I still communicate with Layla. I got close to Layla Ali. I got to know Layla, you know, and I got close to. So that whole cycle just went around the corner and came back.
Well, it's where you were meant to be, man. You know, I feel life is a path that God has already put out there for us. We just follow it, you know. Before I move on, I'll emulate and I'll share something with you and my listeners. The greatest thing that's ever happened in boxing and MMA and all of every aspect that I do is I got to see Muhammad. It was probably early 2000, maybe a little bit before that, and he was doing a speaking engagement, and I was asked to shoot that at the Rancho Royal Sports Complex, and he gave me a book of the Muslims, and he had autographed it for me, and I had never in my life felt so entitled at that moment, because everybody was asking for autographs and this and that, but he
went specifically
out of his way to give me a book of the Muslims. And in about, I think it was 1996, I moved to the Midwest to kind of give my family a better place to live, because California at that time wasn't the greatest place. And I happened to run into an old friend of mine, Leon Spinks, and I knew I had this book. And so I had him sign the other side of it.
Wow.
And for him, he told me, he says, you know what, that is the greatest autograph I've ever given anybody, Don. And I said, why is that? He said, because you allowed me to put my name next to Muhammad Ali's. And that just, people have offered me thousands of dollars for this book, but this book will go with me into the grave. It'll never leave my hands, you know. One thing that inspires me about you, though, Bert. Well, first and foremost, I want to pay honor and tribute to you, especially since the holiday. Thank you for your service to our country and what you've done for all of us. You know, I don't think people respect that enough in life, sir.
With pleasure and honor.
But, yeah. You know, but you made a transition from the boxing world into the sport of mixed martial arts. Now, you first, you know, officially went to work at UFC 95. What was that moment like, receiving that call and getting that opportunity to work for such a prestigious promotion at that time?
Well, let me take you back a little further than that, because you said UFC 95.
Yeah.
Okay. In 2000, as a coordinator, I did the fight in Las Vegas between Oscar De La Hoya and Arturo Gatti. And the guy that hired me said to me, and then, now this was 2000, he said to me, he said, listen, he said, I know a guy, or I had a conversation with a guy that's about to start this new organization and he needs a coordinator. So I recommended that he talks to you. Now, this was during the weigh-in of that fight between Arturo Gatti and Oscar De La Hoya. I may be off on that particular fight, but this was 2000. So I said to the guy, I said, you know what? Fine, I'll talk to him. He brought this guy in to talk to me. The guy was Dana White. Now, this was in 2000. We talked. We had a brief conversation, and he, you know, I'm starting this organization, and, you know, and I'm trying to get some people together, and, you know, they recommended you as a coordinator. And I was told, all I want you to do is do what you do here in boxing for my organization. My thing was, pay me, respect me, you got me. In February of 2001, I did my first UFC, which was UFC 31, baby.
Yeah.
That was the very first one that I did. And I think on that show was, I think Chuck Liddell was on that show. I think BJ Penn was his pro debut. Ricardo Almeida. I remember Kevin Randleman. I think even Randy Couture was on that show. But UFC 31 was my very first show. I did UFC 31, and I was with the UFC for 15 years. I missed three shows in those 15 years. My son got married, and my two daughters got married. That was it. From that point on, every one of them. So that transition, and when I first went to MMA, I was still doing boxing. Dana still allowed me to do boxing because they were, at the time, just kind of putting things together. And I think the first year, I think they did maybe five shows, I think. I think the first year. Now,
yeah, it was five.
The transition between boxing and MMA was that boxing, back then, There was a time I had a show, and I was on my way to the show, and I'm sitting at the airport, and I'm seeing a guy who was the co-main event at the counter trying to find a plane to go home. So I'm asking him, what the heck are you doing trying to get a plane to go home? He said, oh, didn't you hear the fight was canceled? Now, I was at the airport and got a cancellation of the fight. Back then, that's kind of the way it was. You had the capability of fights being canceled 2 days before or the week of for a number of reasons. You know, so I really, you know, Dana didn't say you had to quit boxing. He said, you know, you work your shows, you work our shows. But then the schedule started getting heavy. The schedule started going up. And when if Dana White gave me a schedule on a napkin with 7 projected fights, they happened. If he gave me 10 fights on a napkin projected, all 10 happened. So at the time, I was also working with, you know, I was working with Mike Tyson. I was working with the Klitschko brothers. I was working for Mike Akery, you know, and I was doing shows on HBO or Showtime. But when Dana gave me fights, he gave them to me, they happened. So if he gave me a fight and somebody from boxing called me and said, hey, I got a boxing event such and such, you know, my thing was, well, I'm already booked. Now, I didn't have it in writing, but that's how consistent it was. And they would say to me, you mean to tell me you are going to not take our fight to do that stuff? You know, my answer was, you know what? I have yet to have this stuff not happen. So, you know, I'm a hired gun. I got to chase the money. That was my mentality. And you know what? In the 15 years that I was with the UFC, I think I had one fight canceled. I don't remember what it was, but I think John Jones was involved, or it was a John Jones show. But it was one fight that was canceled. Other than that, if it was mentioned, it happened. And, you know, it eventually got to a point where boxing said, you know what, we can't keep calling you and you not be available. My thing was, you know what, baby, you got to do what you got to do. Because these are secure dates. And, you know, right now I sit back and I look, you know, at every major MMA or UFC superstar for me to have had the opportunity to work with them from that far back to now seeing the progression, you know. And ironically, I sat today and I was flipping through the television, and there was The Ultimate Fighter. And it was the first time, I think, in the last 3.5 years that I've seen Kevin Randleman and Robert Whittaker. Now, I got them guys when they were starry-eyed rookies.
Yeah.
And here they are, you know. I know that at the end of The Ultimate Fighter, they're going to fight. And I understand it's going to be in Australia sometime in February or March. You know? So it's been a progression that I always say that the one thing that I learned as a coordinator, Dom, was I learned how to assess people and situations that I had to make happen. Yeah. I saw that the UFC had legs. I saw that whole wrestling, mixed martial arts had legs. And eventually, I saw that MMA was getting legs. And it did. Because now MMA is a whole different world that's not totally attached to UFC. UFC is the major promoter and the you know, top gun, big dogs. But there's now a world of MMA and a world of combat sports.
Almost definitely. There truly is. You look at where you're at now. Yeah, you look at where you're at now with what you're doing. I mean, you know, I look back and I realize, you know, you had made a statement, and it kind of took me back because, you know, while you were with the UFC, I believe you did, 32 to 35 shows a year, maybe even just a little bit more.
I think between 35 and 40, I would think. Yeah.
And, you know, it made me look back and realize that, you know, I used to be on the road 42 weeks a year. And to sit and look at your thoughts of why, you know, how kind of was an aspect that hindered you, but at the same time, it was a moment that made Burt Watson, not the babysitter of the stars, but Burt Watson, the family man, realize that you may have lost in one aspect, but you were able to contribute and have that time with your family. What did that slowdown mean for Burt Watson being able to, you know, create the aspect with family? Because I know what it's like to be home 4 hours after being on the road for 3 weeks and get a phone call and have to leave again that night. So what did it mean for you to finally get the opportunity to spend that time with your family?
Well, you know, the one thing, and I'll go back to the one question you asked me was, what was the one person that influenced me? And I said, my mom.
Yeah.
I'll also go on and say that I've always had very, very strong family ties growing up as a child. You know, I'm from a family of seven children. I've always had very strong family ties. So when I became a father, those strong family ties stayed with me. How to create and keep those strong family ties stayed with me. And I say luckily, because even though I was on the road, I mean, there were days, I went to sleep in Japan and woke up in Chicago. Went to sleep in Chicago and woke up in Brazil. That's how my life was on the road. But my family ties, or my ties with my family, and my relationship with the family was strong enough that I was able to, when I was home, pick up a little bit. So when I did stop, which, you know, I didn't realize that I had stopped until almost 5 or 6 months out, when I really wasn't doing anything. And I had, when I had my first 60 days or 70 days, 65 days at home was the longest time that I'd been home with my family in 13 years.
That's crazy.
But luckily, I had acquired a bond with my son and my daughter and my grandchildren. And you know what? I watched them grow up through pictures and cell phone tweets and texts and stuff like that. That's kind of how I saw my family grow up. You know, my grandson, just this year, graduated from Yale, plays football. I've got five grandchildren, and two of them are getting ready to follow in his footsteps and go to college. So I was, because I had strong family values, when I grew up, I was able to continue that as a man and a father, and I was lucky because I needed that those 14 years that I was on the road and traveling like a big dog. I was in a 22 round fight, and I think they outlawed 15 round fights with Michael Spinks.
Yes,
sir. Was it Michael Spinks had the 12 round?
Yeah, Michael
fight?
Spinks.
I think they
cut
it. Yeah. So, you know, and it's like that when you get into a fight, you don't realize what round it is or where you are till the fight's over, unless somebody stops it a little early. Well, I was in the middle of a fight and had no idea I'd been in a fight that long. no idea. You know, I looked up and I'm like, wow, 13 years, 14 years. You know, but it went on and it went so fast. You know, I'm going to tell you something, man. Right now, this time that I'm off now, I've gotten the biggest appreciation for the time that I spent and the years that I spent and the people that I got to know. And, you know, this past weekend, You know, I was with Johnny Hendricks and Chris Lieben and Phil Baroni and, you know, guys that I've worked with in the UFC over the years in the past. And about 3 weeks or a month ago, I went to a PFL show, and, you know, I got to see Randy Couture and Eve Edwards. And, you know, and whenever I see these guys, man, it is like, it's like homecoming. You know, but that's what my time and the time with these guys and working with them and watching them grow and watching this sports grow, man, it's what I did. And I am now beginning to appreciate that, because I look at it and I think they appreciate me and what I did.
Yeah, well, I think they still do, sir, and you know, I don't think that appreciation for you will ever go away. You know, I just had Johnny Hendricks, Brennan Ward, Chris Lieben. A lot of the Bare Knuckle Fighting Federation fighters were actually just on my show.
Wow.
And as you heard in the intro, I just did the intro for Golden Boy, as Chuck Liddell had just recently been on the show also.
Chuck and Tito getting ready to do it again.
Oh, yeah. Third time,
you know,
the trilogy.
Yeah. But you know, I have a theory that you know, a lot of times you hear fans say, "When are these guys ever going to give up? Or when are these guys going to stop? Or when are these guys?" And I'm not talking specifically about Chuck or Randy, you know, or Tito. I'm just saying in general, people see their athletes and see their stars and figure they've been around too long. You know what? These guys know when to stop. Their body tells them when it's time for them to stop. And when your body talks to you and tells you, you don't have to listen, because it'll stop on you. You know, it'll stop on you and stop for you. So these guys being able, you know, I know Bernard Hopkins, you know. I did a couple of Bernard Hopkins' first fight when he got out of prison and started with Butch Lewis, and you know, when he fought for the NABF title. Well, I think that was the first title Bernard fought for. And Bernard stayed in the sport till he was almost 50. You know, and that was because you take care of your body and your mind, it'll take care of you. His body and his mind allowed him to do that. You know, right now, you know, Chuck and Tito, bless them. I don't ever cheer for anybody, because they are all my children, and they will always be my children. And I will always be on the fence. That's the safest place and best seat in the house.
Yeah,
you know,
that's the seat I ride, bro.
Hey, man.
That's the seat I ride. You know, because I'm caught up so many times. Like Liam McGarry and Linton Vassell came on my show, and, you know, they were getting ready to fight each other in the UK, and people were like, "How can you interview them at the?" Because they respect each other. You know, I'm not like you. I'm not on my 10th or 15th generation of fighters. I'm on my 5th generation of fighters. But, you know, you brought up a good point. I had Dan Severn on my show, and when he initially went to the UFC, he lied to him about his age. You know, he told him he was 30 when he was actually, you know, just about 40 years old.
Probably 100.
And I get some of these young fighters on my show that tell me, "I'm 34, I'm reaching the end of my career." And I tell them, I said, "You know what? I just had Dan the Beast Severn on. And you need to realize something, son." I said, "You're only old when you realize it." But I said, "Let me tell you something. Do you realize that some of Dan Severn's greatest wins against some of the best athletes in the world came after his 40th birthday?" I said, "So if you look at that
thought, how to do it, pace himself."
Yeah. You know, you got to make it happen. But I want to kind of take a step back real quick before we jump on to a good friend of ours. I want to get your thought, because we talk about the sport. We talked about, you know, life in some aspects so far. But I want to get your thought. I had a tremendous young man on my show named Paul Vaden. And
I think
you know
Paul
back
Vaden.
Yeah, great guy, man. I love him. You look back at his career, and
boxer.
You look back at the Stephon Johnson fight.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say it's a fair assumption that two careers died in the ring that night, sir?
I know Paul Vaden was a very, very nice guy. If that was your question, I'm sorry because this other phone rang. I didn't hear. Could you repeat the end of that question?
I said, would you say that it's a fair assumption to say that in this fight with Stephon Johnson that two careers died in the ring that night?
Well, what I will say is that, and I said to you earlier that when it's time for you to stop or it's time for you to be doing something else, you don't have to make that decision. Your body will make that decision for you. You know, I mean, I've seen fighters get old in the ring, so to speak, and I'm generalizing that. I've seen that happen. I've seen fighters when they got in, going into the fight, you know, they were all prepared for the fight and they get into the fight, and you know what? The body said, It's time. So I've seen that happen before.
Well, what I was referring to, and I don't mean to clarify, I needed to clarify that a little bit better because, you know, most of the sport knows that Stephon Johnson died after that fight.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, I had Paul Vaden on my show, and I asked him that question. And he said that's a fair assumption. But he went on to explain, like you did, that the realization of where life was for him was it was time to give back to the future and give back to, you know, the sport in a different retribute. You know, something truly tremendous happened for a mutual brother of ours this last weekend. Well, it happened months ago, but just this last weekend he was able to put it out there. You know, he's going to get mad at me, but Jacob Duran is a tremendous attribute to the sport, a tremendous, tremendous friend of yours and brother of yours and mine. You know, how proud of you were of Jacob to see him get these opportunities and to finally see him get the justification and the support that he deserves.
Well, and for those of you who don't know who Don's talking about when he say Jacob, he's talking about Stitch, okay? He's talking about my man Stitch, the number one cut man, Stitch. You know, for the most part, when you get into professional sports on any level, in any capacity, your work speaks for itself. Your work normally dictates your longevity. The type of work that you produce and the type of work that you put out dictates, for the most part, how long you're around, how many teams you're on, how many teams you're not on, and how long your career is. Stitch has been on a very high level as long as I've known him. And I can honestly say I probably met Stitch in the early 80s, you know. So his work speaks for himself. You know, I think out of all the cutmen that you know, you probably see Stitch on HBO and Showtime in major fights more so than anybody else with more different fighters. You know, at some point it got to a point where the more high-profile fighters were bringing him on, and his time schedule ran a little crazy. But, you know, I mean, he deserves every accolade, every award, and every presentation he gets. You know, I think they've kind of etched his work in history. I think he was in both of the Creed movies as himself, you know.
Yeah.
It's very rare that people put you in a movie as yourself unless you're a pretty big star, you know, or you substantiated yourself that they can use your original name in a movie. And
yeah.
And that just came to me. I just thought of that they actually let him use. He is in the movie as himself. So,
doesn't happen very often.
No,
you know,
no.
We're set to do a Creed 2 show with some of the cast of characters with Jacob Stitch Duran. I had to throw it. I'm so used to calling him just Jacob.
I know. You said that to me.
But, you know, it's tremendous because the opportunities and the aspects that he sees in me has truly changed my life, you know, and you've truly changed the life of everybody you work with. Now, I'm going to throw the thing back on you because you said something about, you know, you look at every fighter as your child. And you're the only second person in my 23 years of being in this industry that I've ever heard make that assumption. And the only other person was Jacob Duran.
Wow.
He said, every fighter is my child. So when you look at the two of you together, combined, you truly have given the sport the greatest care, the greatest trust, and the greatest belief. It truly says a lot to the foundation of both of you.
That you just trust, belief, those are things that when you get a fighter the week of a fight, he puts all of those things and all of those beliefs in you. He trusts you, he believes you, and he sincerely knows that you're going to try to take care of him. And you know, I don't think it should be any other way. And I never think that one should be treated any better than the other. They all should get the same comfort level. They all should feel that you're looking out for their welfare. You're concerned that they're going to make weight. You're concerned that they got heat in their room, you know, and that they're not in a room that they're staying up all night, or that you've taken the time to make sure that the guys that are fighting each other are not, their rooms are not right next to each other. You know, just little things that you do for them for that entire week to make sure that they get in and out of that cage as safe as possible and with the comfort level in their head that all they got to do is get in that cage and perform and know that somebody's taking care of them. That's something that I tried to do and touch everybody that came my direction. Everybody that I put on a scale, I wanted them to know that I meant for real that they had to make weight. And not because it was a part of the process or a part of the system, but the pride of doing it, the pride of professionalism, and that they were at a level that required them to do that. And I wanted them to know that and feel like that. They had to feel that professional level, you know, that professional confidence. And I did everything I could to make every one of my kids feel that, every one of them. And you know what? They did. And I only know that because they're now telling me. I
know they truly did.
I
know,
did
Elliot funny
Marshall
you
the other day, and he told me. He said that to me, man, and it just, with a little hair I got left, stood up a little bit. And I got a little.
You know, I know that's true because I think it was Mark Coleman that actually, I seen him not, God, it wasn't very long ago, and he shared some pictures with me, and in one of them he has a shirt that says, Bert, don't play. And
yes,
wow. I was dying because it's true, you know. You had to be stern, but it was in the gist of the fighters. You know, you brought up something. I got a couple more questions, Bert, if you don't mind, and then I'll let you get about your evening because I know it's late. But, you know, you look at a situation with Jacob Stitch Duran that he emulated on my show, and he shared with my listeners first one of the greatest moments in all of his career. He was at O2 Arena and doing the Vladimir Klitschko fight. And after round one, he came in there, and Klitschko looked up and he said, you can call me son. And Stitch said, you know, it really tore at his heart, and a tear ran down his face. If you had to look back in the life of Bert Watson, what defining moment truly touched your heart?
There was a show where Anderson Silva had this thing with his children, which he always wanted them around, but, you know, it was very hard to put children in that kind of a setting, in a workout room, in a dressing room, with guys flying and kicking and not really knowing that anybody's around, and guys that are in the room are conscious of it, so they're used to doing that, and they're aware of it. So there's not, you know, there's not a real safety issue, but there still is. Well, I can't remember the fight, but I remember Anderson Silva grabbing his two sons, who somehow one of the security guys brought them in the back for his walkout. And I'm standing there and I'm looking at him, and his music is getting ready to come on, and I had the headset on, and the truck was telling me that they didn't want the children in the shot. They didn't want the children in the shot. And the camera guys and the backstage producer, they all were going up to Anderson Silva and trying to get them children, get, you know. And he was at a point where they're either walking with me or I'm not fighting. And they came to me and they were telling me about the problem they were having. So I walked over to Anderson, and I looked at him, and he had his two kids under his arm. I walked over to him. I grabbed one. He let him go. I grabbed the other one. He let him go. And I had my arm around him, and I said, I can promise you that I will take care of him from here until you get in that cage. And you know what? He let him go. And I turned around and walked away with those two kids, and they were kids. For a man or a parent to give somebody their children that they feel somebody else is going to take care of their children the way they did, you know, that touched me. That's a moment that I will never forget. And I took them two boys, and I walked them to the cage, and I put them in the two seats that they had for the cut men to sit in and the officials, and I sat them down. And I stayed right there until his walkout song came in, and when he got to the cage, he saw them two guys, man, and the first thing he did was hug me, and then he kissed those two guys. That's one of them, I think, that kind of got me a little misty that I'll never forget.
Oh, yeah, it's the ultimate aspect of trust. I mean,
oh, man.
You couldn't ask for
somebody else, yeah, but for me, for a man to give me his children, and he was not walking. He was telling everybody that the kids had to walk with him. But I knew at the time, you know, the way things were, and when that walk from the back of the stage to the cage, that was a pretty crazy walk. Because what they did was the UFC never, ever wanted the fans not to have access to the fighters. So inadvertently, when they put the walk together and they put the seats, a fighter walking to the cage could be touched by anybody. Anybody that was in that front row or close enough to touch him. So, you know, depending, it got a little crazy on that walk. You know, and when you had somebody like Frankie Edgar that ran and didn't walk, everybody in that group had to run. You're talking about maybe 9 people with a camera on his shoulder having to have to run with Frankie Edgar to the cage. Or a guy like Anderson Silva or George St. Pierre or Randy Couture, you know, who the crowd was jumping out of their seats to grab them and touch them. That walk was pretty dangerous, believe me.
Yeah, it truly is. You know, I've been in that situation, you know, quite a few times myself. You know, Bert, sometimes, sir, we have to ask an elephant in the room question, but I'm going to word it the best way I possibly can. Like I told you before we went live, I hold no punches, and I'm complete transparency, and you told me, hey, if I don't want to answer it, I'm not going to answer it. So I tried to figure out through this whole show the best way to articulate and present this question. You know, I know when you left the UFC after 14 years,
mm-hmm.
you didn't give an answer. I'm not expecting you to give an answer on today's show. I'm not. Trust me. But when will Bert Watson open up and let the world know? Or will he forever hold it a secret in his heart?
Well, I'll say to you that it had nothing to do with a fighter. You know, there have been talks about Ronda Rousey, Mark Munoz, and a couple of others being involved. It had absolutely nothing to do with the fighter. It was between Bert Watson and a high-level UFC official, someone that they put in their top echelon, said the wrong thing to me at the wrong time. He threw a left, and I came back with a right in the counter.
I love it. That's, you know, well, because you're true to your game. I mean, that's the OG style.
What he just I felt totally disrespected. I felt, you know, that he was questioning my integrity. He was questioning my work ethics. He was questioning my job performance, and he was questioning how I operated and ran things. That's what I felt. And I felt all those things at once. Now, how that triggered all of that quickly, maybe that was supposed to happen the way it did.
Yeah.
Maybe that was
like
the time.
Like I said earlier,
but the
God creates our path, right?
Hey, the minute he came at me, he threw that left, but the left was a little far out, and I came out with a right and an uppercut. And, you know, that was the end of it. He said the wrong thing. I went back, and that was my last show.
That couldn't have been more of a tremendous answer to my question. You know, a lot of people want to dig in and get the garbage aspect of it. I've never been that way. You know, I created the show for the fighters.
Well,
I
said it like that because I could have given a long story, but the bottom line was somebody said the wrong thing, and I didn't like the way it was said and thought I was disrespected. And when you feel that and you know one thing, Don, I'll tell you something. I told you about my family values and my core values and my mom and all that. One thing that I do, I sleep right every night because I live right. My mom always say, if you lie, you cheat. If you cheat, you steal. I don't do any of those things. So I live right, and I sleep right. So if somebody comes at me wrong, they going to get a right. Hello.
And the left.
That Joe Frazier left.
You know, I love it because that is truly the statement that I felt you would give and articulate. You know, Bert, I want to ask you this question because I've asked legends of the sport this, and, you know, I think it's fitting to ask you. You know, there's opportunities in life that sometimes they grab us. They, for whatever reason, you know, we're walking by a mirror, we're walking by a car window, or even that puddle on the path in the park, and we look down into that water, and we get, for that brief moment, we get a reflection of our life. What does Bert Watson see when he gets that reflection?
Happy. You know, I'm a bit taken back because some of the things that I've done, I'm still shaking my head. I am still shaking my head because I am looking down and that reflection, I'm saying, how the hell did that happen? How the hell did you pull that off and sustained? That's what I see when I look in that reflection. And honest, I've done that walking past a mirror.
Yeah.
But I'm proud of that. And that's, you know, that's the only thing that I could ever take with me. Because everything else you leave behind, somebody's going to put it in their own words. And every word is different.
See, that's why I love my show, because – I always say let the, you know, because people want to take what they take off social media, they want to take off what they see on television, but the only true voice is your voice. The only true story will come out of your mouth.
Yes, sir.
And yes, that's sir. Why I actually let the fighters, my show used to be called something else, and I had a huge following, but I fired my mutual host because he disrespected a fighter on my show, and I don't play that.
You
know?
Familiar.
Yeah, so what I did was I put up on social media, I want to let the sport name my show. They've already gave me the monogram of Barbara Walters, so I said, why not let them name the show, you know? So I did. Well, Pat Miletich don't like it, but, you know, Pat's going to have to live with that moniker. But I put it out there, and they said
my
the fighter's
voice. My man, Pat
Miletich. Yeah, that's my boy.
Yeah.
That's my homie.
Yeah.
He, you know, he compares me to the chief correspondent for the Washington Post. He was mad when he heard the Barbara Walters thing, so he came on the show, and he said, Don, first and foremost, you're not Barbara Walters. He said, yeah, you might be the interview everybody wants. He says, but, and pardon the expression, but I'm going to use his words exactly. He says, you don't have a pair of breasts. And he said, and you're not a crooked journalist.
Right.
He says, what you do is you truly give the story as it should be told. Because on my show, he talked about how his two brothers were molested by a Catholic priest.
Mm-hmm.
And they ultimately committed suicide. And going into UFC 15, he felt the burden of his mother's sorrow on his shoulders.
Wow.
And he told himself, I can't do this. I got to win this championship. So he said he loaded a gun before the fight and put it in the bureau and had told himself that if he didn't win this fight, that he was going to blow his head off. Now, you and I both know that, thank God he won the fight.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
For
wow.
Pat Miletich to tell a story like that on my show, it truly shows that the trust that I have in the sport goes back to what you're saying. You got to ride that line.
Mm.
You got to be in the middle, and you got to have the best seat in the house.
And you don't
truly
know
that's the only way you can exist.
These guys come for a fight, fight week. You don't know what's really in their head or what's not, but you got to make everybody. Everybody has to get a comfort level and feel that you really, really care.
Yeah.
Because you
it's
don't.
It's hard. It truly is hard. And see, I think that's why I've wanted you on the show so much. And like I told you, you know, we talk about OG status. Well, you know, in our industry, we do everything by protocol. And
yes, sir.
I don't reach out. Man, people say, man, Don, you got some of the greatest aspects of the sport as friends on your page, why don't you ask? I said, because I don't roll like that. You know, but for the first time in my 23 years in this industry and 15 years in journalism, I asked Jacob to bring you on the show. It was something I had to do, sir. You know?
Real OG.
Yes, sir. It truly is. So on this parting question.
Yes, sir.
Of the show, and It's truly been an honor, and I would love to have you back on in the future.
It's been my pleasure.
On this parting question, it's kind of deep, man, because what you've created in fighters' lives, what you've instilled in family, what you've instilled in the inner workings and even the fans, it can't be duplicated. So when it's all said and done, how would Bert Watson like to be remembered?
That he was for real. That he was for real. Because everybody, you know, wants to know that you're for real. That you really mean it. And when somebody feels that you're for real, they give you the real deal. They give it to you. They don't go around the corner and give you, you know, an imaginary situation. When they feel you're for real, they're for real with you. And when you get that from somebody, but you got to know that you're getting that, and you got to know how to give that. Just know that Bert Watson is for real. Period.
That's why I had to have you on the show, because you truly are not just inner workings or an aspect of a sport. You truly are the sport. If it wasn't for you, the sport wouldn't be where it is today. You know, you've made a lot of fighters grow up. You made a lot of fighters realize when they were being ignorant, you made them realize the path that they needed to follow. And it's not an easy job to do. And you've done it with elegance, and you still continue to do it to this day. You know, Bert, it was truly an honor and a privilege to be able to interview such a man of such high caliber and esteem and integrity as yourself. You know, I don't get an opportunity to have people like you that really made this sport what it is today on my show. And for that, I'm eternally grateful.
Well, you know, I truly appreciate it. It's been an honor. It's been a real pleasure. And, you know, anytime, you know, that I can make myself available, you know, I like to try to keep up with, you know, the world. I'm not totally as involved as I used to, and this is one of the ways that I can keep up with everybody. And I love keeping up with everybody and love to know what everybody's doing. You know what, and want to share what I'm doing. So whatever the next chapter is, I'll be glad to be on your show, and I'll share that with you.
Oh, most definitely. There's so much the legacy and the foundation of Bert Watson. I don't think a 10-hour show can do you justice, sir.
Uh-huh.
I truly don't think it is. You know, next time, what we'll do,
yes,
is
sir,
I'll have Jacob be on the show with us, and we'll do a roundtable, you and Jacob Fitch Duran, and we'll roll a show out that way. You know,
well,
Bert,
I appreciate it, and thanks for having me, Don, and much pleasure to you, and I'm wishing you and everybody in your listening ear, you know, a happy holidays and a great Christmas and Thanksgiving and New Year's, and if I don't hear from you or talk to you before then, please have a good, safe one. All those things are coming up, and you got to be safe if you want to be around.
Most definitely. Thank you so much, sir. I'm going to pass the
pleasure
mic to you. If there's anything else you'd like to add to the show before I let you go, the floor is yours, sir.
Just that everybody, I mean, I try to be as active on social media as I can, you know, and if anybody ever want to reach out to me on all social media, Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, Bert Watson, the number 4, real. Bert Watson, for real.
It's truly been an honor, sir.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and God bless
Always
you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, baby.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the one and only Bert Watson, the babysitter of the stars. You know, I tell you what, the part for me that truly inspired me is he gave an answer in a roundabout way to why he left the UFC. And you heard it here first, but in an articulated manner. And that's a true blessing. I mean, if you're not into combat like I am, I can understand if you don't really take the gist of it like I did. But to truly hear Bert Watson give an answer that he's never done before to why he left the UFC, you heard it here first. With that being said, I want to thank Finished MMA, Juan Martinez, the 86ers.net, with Alfred and Freddie, Cutman for Hire with Jacob Stitch-Duran and Juan Rodamares, Bite Me Mouth Guards with Joe Rice. And on that note, I'm going to take us out with a commercial. Have a good night, and God bless.
What up, it's your boy Slone Bone of the Mo Thugs Movement, part of the Bone Thugs and Harmony family tree, the 86ers brand ambassador. Check it out though, listen, in a world full of followers, be proud to be different, be an 86er. So what I need y'all to do is go to the 86ers.net. We got the dopest apparel, men and women, everything you need for a fresh start. I'm talking tees, zip-ups, tanks, hoodies, and the best hats. At a price nobody can match. I'ma ask you this though. What do your clothes say about you? If you don't know, come to the 86ers.net and find yourself out. And a special shout out to Don McGuire, the host of the Fighter's Voice. Salute, big homie.
Laura.